The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. Today we have a growing internal Tory row in the Commons, one that the opposition are all too happy to get involved in, and it relates to what has come to be known as the Genocide Amendment. James, can you talk to us about what this is and how it relates to the trade bill which is coming before the House?
It is an amendment that started off in the House of Lords, and it essentially would mean that if the High Court in London decided that a country was guilty of genocide, then any trade agreement with it would fall. And, you know, but there is another amendment down today which would suggest slightly changing it so that the Commons would vote on whether it should fall or not. Now, the government is resisting this amendment, and it makes kind of two arguments. One is, is it the right place for the courts to make that decision? Surely if there was an evidence of genocide going on, Parliament itself should wish to act to bring to an end any trade agreement with that country. And then its second kind of slightly more pragmatic argument is, look, this is clearly aimed at China and its treatment of the Uyghur Muslims, and there is no prospect of any trade deal with China. I think that what worries the government is that you get into a slippery slope and that you get court cases brought alleging that X, Y, Z countries engaged in human rights abuses, that then turns into a case about whether it's genocide or not. I think the significance of this is what it shows is there's been a dramatic change in UK approach to China. It's remarkable to think that only a year ago, the government was defending the idea of having Huawei, a company very close links to the Chinese military, play a crucial role in the building of the UK's 5G network. But I think what this shows is that the political pressure on a bipartisan basis is all for an even tougher line. And I think what we can see is that viewing China as a threat to the rules-based international order is now going to be a feature of UK foreign policy over the coming decades. If Lisa Nandy was sitting where Dominic Raab is now, I think UK policy towards China would be the same or even tougher. And that is a big shift, because when foreign policy shifts are accepted by both main parties, they become permanent features of a landscape.
Now, Isabel, part of the shift in terms of the government position has A, been the pandemic, looking at how China responded, but two, it began on the Tory backbenches, a hardening initially against Huawei when it was a rebellion the government hoped to see off. And we have one of the many research groups, we have the China Research Group, which is made up of lots of strong characters. Do you think that ultimately, they are the driving force now, which is we can see opposition parties want to work to make sure this amendment goes against government wishes. Do you think it's those MPs that Number 10 needs to win over? Do you think actually it's quite hard to get those people to change their mind?
I think it is quite hard to get those people to change their mind, because they are, a lot of them are in quite independent positions within the Commons. So you've got Jeremy Hunt, the former Foreign Secretary, who I think is planning either to vote against or to abstain, so he won't be backing the government. And then you've got Tom Tugendhat, who is the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. So these are people who have got careers in the Commons that are outside of the government, which makes them much less biddable. And they've been plugging away on this issue for quite some time now and have become increasingly impassioned about the need to change Britain's relationship with China. And as James has written in the magazine this week and over the past few months, they have led to a shift in Britain's stance towards China and have made it much more uncomfortable for ministers to even consider some of the relationships that were perfectly normal and that ministers thought were defensible a year ago when they were defending the government wanting to use Huawei to build parts of the 5G network. So it is going to be difficult. And it also against the backdrop of a parliamentary Conservative Party which is really still doing its own thing. Boris Johnson's leadership is not in question at the moment, as Steve Baker suggested last week that it might be, but I would say that his authority still is, in that MPs feel that they can rebel, they can express their views independently without either getting into trouble or actually without feeling that they're damaging the Conservative cause. They think that they're helping their party by speaking out and by rebelling, which is an awkward position for a prime minister to be in, even if ultimately what they are pushing for is the right thing and is indeed helpful because it takes their party into a much better place on certain issues, including China.
James, looking, I suppose, on a more international level, what do you think the repercussions of this are in terms of other countries and how they see the UK government response?
Well, I think the UK's position on China and the toughening of it is going to be important. You know, you've got a new American president being inaugurated tomorrow in Joe Biden. I don't think he is going to change the Trump administration's tougher line on China, but I think he's going to be much more interested in working with allies and alliances on this. It's well worth reading a piece by Kirk Campbell in Foreign Affairs. Kirk Campbell is widely tipped to take on the role of coordinating Asia policy in the Biden White House. And he basically sets out a series of steps that the US should take to counter China, all about building more alliances. And interestingly, in that piece, he endorses this idea of a D10, or an alliance of 10 democratic states that the UK is planning to launch at the G7 meeting this year. And I think that in Whitehall, but the view is that China is an entry point with the Biden administration, and also particularly because the EU's decision to sign this investment treaty with China, something that Jake Sullivan, the incoming National Security Administration, made clear publicly he didn't think the UK should do, because he would rather have a joint Western approach to these questions. It does give them an entry point. I mean, there is a feeling that this is a chance to say to the Biden administration, look, we know many of you didn't like Brexit at the time, but on your foreign policy priorities, from China to climate change, we are very closely aligned with you. I mean, that is going to be the UK government's message to the Biden team. And I think the other big thing is that, you know, I think this year has changed lots of Western states' attitudes to China. Just look at what has happened to Australia. Australia had a very close economic relationship with China, and it then called for an independent inquiry into the origins of COVID. And China essentially tried to turn that relationship on Australia, you know, putting tariffs on Australian goods, rejecting food, meat from Australian, various Australian abattoirs. And I think what you see here is that President Xi abandoned the kind of peaceful rise policy this year and became much clearer about what China's intentions were. And so I think that has made it easier to rally alliances to counter China. And I think what you see with the Trump administration was it was very happy to act unilaterally. It wasn't really interested in building alliances. I think what you will see from Biden is a far greater emphasis on building alliances across Asia to try and counter and contain China.
Isabel, as James points out, we are on the last day of Donald Trump, end of an era I think many are quite keen to end. When it comes to, I suppose, what the UK government is doing now, do you think that they are acting differently in anticipation of Biden than they would be, say, if Trump was looking at another term?
Yeah, I think so. And I think also it's been interesting to watch the change of tone as the inauguration approaches, and following the violence on the Capitol, you have seen finally a hardening of the tone towards Donald Trump. There's a really interesting piece in the Mail today by former Cabinet Secretary Mark Sedwill, where he says that he thinks that those who have said Boris Johnson would have preferred a second Trump term are mistaken. That would not have been to the benefit of British or European security, to transatlantic trade, let alone the environmental agenda to which the Prime Minister is so committed. But I think it's still fair to say that the Biden presidency presented a number of quite obvious problems for Boris Johnson from the outset, not least in terms of transatlantic trade and also in terms of foreign policy. Donald Trump's general agenda domestically, I think, has eclipsed some of the decisions he took internationally, which are probably much more in line with Boris Johnson's instincts than Joe Biden's. And there is an anxiety from some in Whitehall and in Westminster that actually we might return to a Barack Obama-style era of foreign policy, where you have, you know, looking back at the Barack Obama presidency, one of the great failures of foreign policy was over Syria and over Obama's insistence that there were red lines that he then allowed Bashar al-Assad to cross and with impunity. And so to go back to that sort of soft, slightly messy foreign policy era that we had under Barack Obama is something that I suppose a certain section of the Conservative Party are quite anxious about.
Now, finally, we had hearing calls for a resignation. It's for Gavin Williamson to go, and it's Kate Green, the Shadow Education Secretary. James, Gavin Williamson's been under fire for a while, so why do you think Labour is doing this now? And do you think Boris Johnson is going to turn around and say, OK, yes, farewell, Gavin?
I think, as you say, the timing is slightly surprising, because Gavin Williamson has had some, as Israel has been chronically on Coffee House, has had a very difficult pandemic. But there's not a good current immediate crisis which would explain why you would call for him to go now. I think it's highly unlikely that either Gavin Williamson is going to resign or Boris Johnson is going to sack him. I think it is also quite likely that in a reshuffle, Gavin Williamson would probably move jobs. And I think, you know, I think his real passion and interest has always been more in the party and parliamentary management side of things rather than in kind of policy questions. And so I think it wouldn't be at all a surprise to see him go back to doing something more along those lines. I think for Labour, though, that they are obviously going to keep attacking on free school meals, on the provision of online learning. And I think you can't get around this fact that the fact that as soon as schools were closed and the shift to remote learning happening, the government felt the need to cancel exams was essentially an admission of how unequal that provision still is and of how socially unjust that situation is. And I think that is something that will be a problem. And I think the kind of one of the great successes under both the end of the last Labour government and the coalition government and the Tory government has been to kind of close the attainment gap between rich and poor. I think the real worry is that COVID and the school closures and the failures of remote learning have massively unwound that progress.
Isabel, what do you think Labour are up to here? Because in the past, we've heard about smart opposition. Apparently, one plank of that is not asking for things that aren't going to happen because you begin to look a bit ineffective if you're calling for things and then nothing materialises. So is this a new type of smart opposition? Are they redefining it or am I reading too much into it?
I think we are entering a new phase of Keir Starmer's leadership where he wants to set out what he stands for and not be so much concerned just with competence and with responding to the government's policies with a sort of bit of support, but also a bit of caution. I think we're going to see a little bit more definition, but where that fits into this beyond not being so cautious, it isn't quite clear. And I think it is a bit of a misstep because, as James says, there's not really any likelihood of Boris Johnson firing Gavin Williamson in the next few weeks. And therefore, they've lost some political capital. They've expended political capital on something that isn't going to happen. And you do want to ration the number of times you call for someone to resign. You can't then call that in 6 months later when he gets moved in a reshuffle and say, ah, yes, we called for that, because it doesn't really work that way. You generally want to be part of a head of steam that's building up. And I covered education questions yesterday in the Commons, and you know, things are very awkward for Gavin Williamson. Every question was about a different problem that his department is not dealing with particularly well. And he might have been cheered by the fact that he'd managed to get some backbenchers along to ask supportive questions and to complain about exaggeration of some of the issues. As James says, that's a sort of testament to his ability in party management. But the fact that those backbenchers had to come along at all to be supportive shows what difficulty he's in. But it wasn't one of those sessions where you think, oh, he's hanging by a thread. You just thought he's had a terrible pandemic and that's probably going to continue for quite a while.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.